always been Christians, Seventh-day Adventists, who have been dealing with depression. And so a couple of months back, I asked Dr. Gillette if he had a topic, a sermon on that. And then Pat Wolf had made all the arrangements for this weekend. And this morning, I'm just thankful, Dr. Gillette, that you took the time to present this sermon. And the weekend, I know we're going to gain a blessing from it. Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor. It's really humbling. I don't know if you can call yourself humble, but it sure sets me back, at least, to stand at the pulpit. And I always feel like when I talk, unfortunately, I get a lot of opportunities to talk, but I always feel like I need to explain why an internist is talking about mental health. When I was doing my residency at the University of Virginia, we have electives. And I asked if one of the electives, I said, well, could I do a psych rotation? Because I need to learn about this because I'm not real comfortable with it. And I know there's a lot of it out there. And they looked and they said, well, we really don't have one. I said, oh, okay. So in the course of 3 years of training, I got a couple lectures on psychiatry. And it was good because when I was a medical student, I'll never forget seeing a patient who was quite agitated in a locked up ward that scared me to death. And I decided, no, I don't want to go into psychiatry. But anyway, so how did I end up standing here? And we're talking about a biblical case of depression this morning. We're going to talk about sort of the practical aspects of how do you communicate? What things do you say? What is depression? More nitty-gritty workshop type stuff this evening, because I feel like this morning is sacred time. This is God's time, and I want to focus on His Word. And then tomorrow we're talking about Alzheimer's disease. Well, about 10 years ago, actually it was just a little over 10 years ago, I was had a busy internal medicine practice. I was the medical director up at the Manor, and it was actually in December of 1999, just before Y2K. Still had kids at home. Choir was going full bore in December. Life was pretty busy. I was head elder here, and I remember that fall I realized I had one weekday a month off, one weeknight a month off, because things were kind of busy. So, well, anyway, in the midst of all this, I get an email. And 10 years ago, emails weren't quite as common as they are now, but we still got emails. And I got this email. It says, Dear Dr. Gillette, we'd like to invite you to be on an educational advisory board for Alzheimer's disease sponsored by Johns Hopkins University. I thought, wow, that sounds kind of neat. And so in my haste and in my busy life, I said, sure, that sounds like fun. So I didn't say it would sound like fun. I said, yes, I'd be honored to be part of this. And so life was kind of busy again, and they made arrangements for me to fly to a meeting in New York. And I'd never done anything like this before. And as things kind of developed, I realized that, and actually it was when I was on the airplane, I was starting to fly over to New York across the country. And I had time to think about it, and I thought, why did they pick me? And I came to the conclusion that the most likely explanation was that there was another Pat Gillette that they really wanted to have on this board. And I was going to show up. I honestly thought this. I was going to show up and they were going to go, oh, you're the wrong guy. And I thought, are they going to make me pay for the airplane ticket to go home? You know, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, maybe, you know, the other choice would be that there will be 300 or 400 doctors and I'm just, you know, I just won the Oregon lottery and got to go to this meeting. And one of the things that convinced me or helped secure that is that they said someone would meet me in baggage claim at the airport. And I thought, they're going to be looking for this other guy. And I'm going to be wandering around in baggage claim for hours. And you know, what am I going to do? And we didn't have cell phones back then like we have now. So I was a little nervous about this. And so I got off the airplane, walked down to baggage claim. And here was this guy standing there in his little black suit with his little black hat with says Dr. Gillette on it. I said, oh, good, that's me. I said, good. And so I knew enough about, I'd never been to New York City before, but I knew enough about New York City to know that the high rent district of New York City is Manhattan. And the high rent district of Manhattan is right at the southern edge of Central Park. Okay? Big, beautiful park. You can oversee it and everything. And so I get in the town car, and the guy drives me into this hotel, which is a pretty nice hotel. I get escorted up to a one-bedroom suite overlooking Central Park. at the southern edge. It's like, oh, I'm so the wrong guy. I'm in so much trouble. And I get in there, and there was this little silver tray with, this is in January, okay? Chocolate dipped strawberries, you know, and handmade, they were obviously handmade chocolates, little bottle of cognac, which I didn't imbibe. In fact, I still have, do we still have it? Yeah, we still have it, unopened. But as sort of a memento, and a little note written in gold leaf, welcoming me to New York City and hoping that I would enjoy my stay. And I was just like, phew, this is so over the top. So also sitting on the table was a binder. And I open up the binder, agenda for the next day, because I my flights got delayed and I didn't get in until quite late that night. Agenda for the next day, breakfast at 7 a.m. I don't know why they do that to people from the West Coast, but 7 a.m. is 4 a.m. But it turned out it was no problem because I didn't sleep that night. I was scared to death. And then I turned the page, and this is for an Alzheimer's meeting, and it had the list of attendees. And there weren't 300 or 400. I sort of figured that out by now. There were 9 people on this board. And as I read down the list, it was who's who in Alzheimer's disease. These are the people that when I go to national meetings and when I see their articles or have their books, I refer to them a lot. Okay? These are the biggest names that we have. And so, and then it said Patrick Gillette from Medford, Oregon. I thought, boy, they're going to be so disappointed tomorrow. So I kind of got ready for the morning. At 7 a.m., I'm there. I'm the first person there because everybody else knows that they don't have to get there until about 7:45. But I was there at 7 a.m., and the first person I saw was the lady who sent me the first email, Rachel DiPaolo. I said, Rachel, I thought, this is great. I can get this over with, maybe catch an early flight and go home. I said, Rachel, hi, I'm Pat Gillette. She said, oh, Dr. Gillette, thank you so much for coming. Okay. And then it was just a burning question, and I asked this question. I said, are you sure I'm the right Pat Gillette? Honestly, I did. I asked that question. Are you sure I'm the right Pat Gillette? And is anybody here from New York? People from New York, okay, can kind of look, give you this look like that was really a stupid thing to say, right? Right? Yeah, like that, yeah. Anyway, that was a stupid thing to say. Well, she started to get this look on her face, and she smiled. Then she smiled graciously, and she said, well, you're from Medford, Oregon, right? So then I was able to smile because she mispronounced Oregon for me. And I said, how did you get my name? I wasn't off the hook because I figured if, you know, I had supposedly done something, I was still the wrong guy. I said, how did you get my name? She thought for a minute. She said, you know, I really don't know. And I said, that's great. I'm the right guy then. And she started to get that look back. Well, but what happened was, and what I've learned since then is that that was quite an unusual thing for a guy just to be plucked out and put on a national board. Usually you go through steps to get there. And so I really think that God had something to do with that. He had a lot to do with that. But it gave me an opportunity to not only help develop an educational program that was very successful, but also to rub shoulders with these giants in Alzheimer's disease. So as I was learning from them and having breakfast and lunch and dinner and just, it was, we had several, a couple times a year I'd go back and we communicated all the time. I learned a lot. And as I learned these things, I took it back to my practice and applied it and started. And, you know, when Johns Hopkins says that you're an expert in Alzheimer's disease, it's kind of scary because you had better be up to speed. And so, but fortunately, with all the support of these friends of mine now, I was able to kind of get up to speed and meet with them and learn these things. And then, but also, since I was on a national board, I all of a sudden became recognized, you know, I was a target. They could see me and, okay, we want you to be on this board. And one of the boards I was on was asked to be on another national board, had to do with atypical antipsychotics, okay? Treating schizophrenia. Well, it's something that we use in low doses in treating some of the agitation of Alzheimer's disease, even though there's a black box warning about it. And so I got on this board, and, you know, I was coming in with this Alzheimer's background and this tremendous experience with this medication, and a family practitioner in this group that we also met a couple times a year, and I started to get to travel a little bit. It was kind of fun back then. he was talking one day about a patient that he had in his practice and how he worked it up and was, you know, was her doctor for a long time and diagnosed her with bipolar disorder. And I looked at him and I said, Sloan, you diagnosed somebody with bipolar disorder, your family practitioner? He says, no, I can do that. I said, does that mean I can do it too? And he said, yeah, you could do that too. I said, okay, teach me. And so we and Sloan is still a really good friend of mine, and I get to see him later, next week. But anyway, and as I learned about this and took it back to my practice, I found, lo and behold, that there was this whole element of depression and bipolar disorder that I was missing in my practice. And I had specific cases that came up that where I had missed it, and which is not uncommon. And we'll talk more about that tonight. But as I learned about these things and applied it to patients, when I first came here back to the Valley in 1991, I opened up a practice in Ashland. I was an emergency room doctor in Ashland, became the director of the ICU, CCU at the Ashland Hospital, which isn't that big, but it still had a lot of responsibility, and then eventually became chief of medicine at Ashland Community Hospital, and still being an emergency room doctor. And it's really neat. I mean, one of the things that's a great benefit in medicine is you get to influence lives. And in the emergency room, I can't remember their names, but I can remember faces, and I can remember a lot of the case history of people 20 years ago that came into the emergency room and should have died. But by God's grace, I was able to figure out what was wrong with them, get on it, and save their life. I mean, I remember one, one particular case of a man, this was in Virginia, a man who was flying a small airplane, a little Cessna airplane, and he was right over Roanoke, which is where we lived and where the hospital was, and he had a heart attack and passed out. Fortunately, the man riding next to him in what's called the right-hand seat was an instructor and knew how to fly from the right-hand seat, dropped the plane just straight down to the airport, declared an emergency room, cleared the airport, dropped it down. Within 45 minutes of this guy passing out, he was in the emergency room with a massive heart attack. We gave him medicine to dissolve the clot, and it dissolved the clot. His heart revived, and he walked out of the hospital about 4 days later. This man should have died, okay? But it's so neat to walk away from that and go, wow, that was a save, you know? It's just really a rewarding thing. Well, what I've found in dealing with mental illness, and we'll get into the sermon here in just a minute, but what I've found with mental health, and especially dealing with depression and bipolar disorder, is that I get at least as much reward as saving somebody's life, being part of that. And one of the reasons is it changes lives, just like Jesus changing your heart. When someone who has struggled with a disease for 30 or 40 years, mental illness, and all of a sudden you hit the right combination of medications and therapy and everything, and you watch their life change. I mean, I've seen people go from being forklift operators to within a year and a half being the head of the IT department for the same company. Okay? I've seen lives change. And so that's kind of what drives me. That's my passion in dealing with this, and I really enjoy it. So this morning, we're going to kind of look at a case of depression. And if you look it through the Bible, there are different cases. And one of the questions that we want to answer, and I want you to think about this, and hopefully you can answer without answering it directly, is it okay to be a depression, or can you still be a Christian and be depressed? And before you answer, I mean, I see heads. You know, some people are going, I don't know, I haven't thought about that one before. Well, think about it a little bit. And we're gonna delve into 1 Kings, and actually the story starts in chapter 17. And this is the story of Elijah. Elijah the Tishbite. Now, Elijah was kind of an interesting guy. He came from a little town which is off of the brook Cherith, Tishbe, that dumps into the River Jordan. He comes in a bad time because there's a king, an evil king, one of the most evil kings to date. And this is Ahab. And Ahab was a bad guy. And he built temples to Baal and everything. And you have to wonder about Ahab's mental well-being, but that's not what we're focusing on. Because if you read through this, and just kind of to pour this together, Elijah was chosen by God. Now, there's kind of a joke in, it's not really a joke, but there's a rhetorical question that's kicked around in psychiatry, and that is, why is it when you talk to God, it's called prayer, when God talks to you, it's called schizophrenia? And they kind of ask it seriously, because it does sound kind of funny, but because that's sort of where we are right now. So we're going to take what knowledge we have now and kind of look back at Elijah's life and see what's going on. I don't think he's schizophrenic, but he did hear God's voice. So Elijah did something very interesting. He did a lot of things very interesting, but the thing I want to focus on is what he did on Mount Carmel. Because if you picture this on Mount Carmel, Elijah told Ahab, after the drought and all those things, told Ahab, look, you get 450 of your priests, okay, and meet me on Mount Carmel. Kind of a gutsy thing to do. I mean, one little guy versus 450 of these priests. And, you know, we kind of, you know the story, what happened. And you have to wonder what's going through Elijah's mind at this time. I'm wondering if he's saying, I wonder if I'm really the right guy, you know, like I did. You know, maybe there's someone else will show up and help me out, you know. And no, he was there by himself. And, you know, the story goes that all day long, the priests of Baal were jumping up and down, trying to get fire to come down from heaven and start their sacrifice. And so when nothing, and they even cut themselves, and they were just getting louder and louder and louder. So finally, Elijah said to the people, says, look, okay, come around. This is what we're going to do. And he had this old broken down altar up there. So he takes the rocks and he gathers 12 stones, as they do in the Old Testament, to build an altar. And then they built a little trough around it, and he put an oxen on it and poured water over it. Okay? Lots of water over it. I mean, a couple 55-gallon drum types of water over this thing. And then he said, okay, hear me, O Lord. Hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord. Okay, so he's taking this already before anything happens. He says, this is yours. Okay? And how did he know that? I mean, did he all of a sudden have this voice or this revelation that this was going to happen? No, he knew God for a long time. Okay? And so God was his best friend. And so he says, okay, here it is. Show them that you're God. Turn your hearts back to you. Take everybody's, all these people that are standing around here, turn their hearts back to you. And so then fire came down from heaven, consumed everything. And then it's kind of interesting what happened after that. And I was really struggling and trying to make the chronology of this work, and it doesn't work. So let's just take the story as it's written in the Bible. And that is, he says, okay, grab those 450 guys. Okay? This is a little rough and it might be a little cruel, but he took them down to the brook and he executed them with a sword. That's going to take a little bit of time, okay? That's why I have a chronology problem here. And then, so then after going through all that, he goes to Ahab and says, okay, go ahead and get something to eat. I'm going to be busy talking to God. But I'm going to warn you that rain is going to come, because we've had this famine, this drought in the land. Rain is going to come. And so Ahab goes off and he starts eating and drinking. And you know, have you ever been through a real emotional thing? Okay, good or bad? When you kind of recover from it, what happens? You're kind of hungry and you're tired. Okay, what's Elijah doing? He's praying. And so Elijah's there praying, and he says, Ahab, oh, by the way, Ahab, you better be ready to run, because when the rain comes, it's going to come fast and hard, and if you don't start right away, you're not going to make it home. Okay? So he prays, and seventh time, servant says, oh, there's a little tiny cloud the size of a man's hand out on the horizon. And Elijah says, let's go. It's time to roll. And then Elijah does something very amazing. He runs a marathon in somewhere around 2 hours. Okay? Pretty good, Henry. Huh? I mean, if you figure a chariot just kind of going along for 20 miles is going to go about 10 miles an hour. Okay? So he does pretty close to a world record marathon run. Now, I happen to know what that feels like. Okay, this last October, no, I didn't do a world record. I mean a marathon. This last October, since Henry started this in our family, and 2 years ago, almost to the day, I read a book that said, yeah, you could do this. And so I said, well, I can do this. So I went and did the Portland Marathon in October and finished. I didn't do it in 2 hours. It's not a world record, but I finished. And it was pretty amazing. Is anybody here? How many people have run a marathon or finished a marathon? Nobody else? You need to read the book. Okay, we'll get the book for you. But anyway, so here's Elijah. I mean, what an incredible thing to do, to run 20 miles after not eating. You know, and he was kind of busy when the priests of Baal were jumping around. I doubt if he was sitting there having a picnic while they were doing it. And so here he goes, and he gets there. So Ahab then goes in and talks to Jezebel. Okay? We won't spend time on Jezebel, but just Jezebel had some problems too, I think. But when Ahab told Jezebel what happened, you know what he said? He said, "This is what Elijah did." What did Elijah say? "Hear me, O Lord, that they may know that you are the Lord God." Okay? So we're building up to this. Are you really excited about this? So then Jezebel says, "You killed you let him kill 450 of my priests? I mean, these are the guys I have dinner with and they hang out together. We have a good time. And you let him kill them all?" And Ahab probably said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Well, I'm going to get Elijah. Send some messenger to Elijah." And then there's some interesting words in here that I'd never really seen before. In 1 Kings 19, verse 3, actually 2, Jezebel sent some messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also." This is Jezebel saying, the gods being her gods, the Baal ones. "Let the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." In other words, the same thing that happened to my 450 priests is going to happen to you unless my gods strike me down. Okay? Actually, a pretty safe bet for Jezebel if she knew what was going on. But then what this next verse 3, he says, "And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there." What would make Elijah run for his life? What do you think would have happened to Elijah had the fire not come down from heaven and consumed the altar? Wait. And who probably would have done it? Well, probably one of the priests or Jezebel would have just... So was he afraid for his life? What would make him drop everything and run? I don't think he was afraid for his life. What? Low blood sugar, yeah. Low carbs, yeah. Needed a little. Well, I think, because if you look at this, going down a little farther, he prayed that he die. He says, "Lord, just take me." Okay, we'll get into that in just a minute. But go back and read those words again. It says, "And when he saw that," what did he see? What he saw is that Ahab told Jezebel what? That Elijah did this. What was Elijah's purpose? To show that God did it. Did Elijah fail? What frightened Elijah so much that he went running? He felt like he failed God. I mean, it's just one possible explanation. But he was so in tune with God, he saw the power of God come down and consume an altar. And then the message didn't get transmitted. He failed God. And it was so bad, it was so horrible for him that he took off running. Can you go with me with that? I mean, is that feasible? Okay. Good. I thought this was kind of neat. And so then he goes out and sits underneath the broom tree. He goes about a day's hike, which is, you know, probably 3 or 4 miles, goes out and sits under a broom tree, or some people call it a juniper tree. And I don't know about you, but juniper trees don't smell real good. I wouldn't want to sit underneath one. But there he is sitting underneath it, and he said, "It's enough. Lord, just take my life, for I'm no better than my father's." Okay, low blood sugar. We have no evidence that he'd eaten in here, but we know that he was running for his life, and he left everything behind, including his servant, which is a pretty big deal. So there he is, and he just laid down and went to sleep, wishing that he would never wake up. Okay? And I'm starting to get a feel here that something's going on here, okay? Because that's one of the questions we're going to talk about a little more tonight, but that's one of the questions I ask people when I'm talking to them with mood disorders or, you know, depressive states is, do you ever wake up in the morning and wish you hadn't? It's a simple, non-threatening way to find out if somebody is thinking about suicide. Okay? If they say, yeah, I do feel that way. They say, yeah, I've been on call all weekend and slammed, and Monday morning I was sorry I woke up, but it wasn't that I wanted to be dead. How often do you feel this way would be the next question. Is it once a week, once a month, once a year? How often? Well, talked to a guy earlier this week that it's daily. Every day he wakes up, he just goes, man, I wish I wasn't alive. And so that's kind of an approach to suicidality. And, you know, we see all these ads on television about people with crushing substernal chest pain that go to the emergency room right away and they can dissolve the clot and save your life. Or if you have a stroke, you need to get there within 45 minutes of the stroke and then they can dissolve that clot and you can be cured for your stroke, okay? I mean, there are lots of little things about getting there really fast, but we don't see ads saying, if you're feeling like killing yourself, get to the emergency room so we can save your life. But in fact, they have a better chance if they're getting support than if they're sitting by themselves. So anyway, getting back to Elijah. Elijah's sitting there going, I wish I were dead. He didn't make any plans. He didn't, you know, hold a gun to it. Oh, he didn't have guns back then. He didn't hold a knife to his throat. He apparently didn't have any plans for committing suicide, which is a little more, you know, you take a little comfort in that. You don't have to rush him to the emergency room for that one. But they need some help. So he fell asleep. He was exhausted. He was exhausted physically, mentally, and spiritually, okay? Because that happens after you do things like that. And so he kind of fell asleep, and then an angel came and woke him up and said, you need to eat something. Kind of important. And not just anything. I like to think that the angel prepared it for him. So you know it was the right thing to eat, which is kind of important. You know, stopping at Taco Bell on the way home, you know, that's probably isn't what he got. He got something a little more nutritious than that. In fact, it was quite nutritious than that because after he had a couple of these meals, he went off and he went for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, this starts to cause a little bit of problem with me. And that is, you know, going for 40 days and 40 nights is one of the signs that we look for with somebody's having mania. Doesn't mean everybody who does that has mania, but it's something. Now, he's shown that he was depressed, and now he's showing that he's swung the other way. He has more energy than he can handle, okay? And he's going for 40 days and 40 nights, and he goes over 100 miles, probably about 120 miles from where he was, to Mount Horeb. Now, Mount Horeb, there's one camp that says it's Mount Sinai, and there's another camp saying we really don't know where it is. But it was a fur piece, as they say in Virginia. It was a long way off. So even when he gets all this and he goes for 40 days and 40 nights, what happens? He sits in a cave. And he's going, oh, woe is me. And then something really amazing happens, and that is the Lord came to him and said, What are you doing here, Elijah? Does that sound familiar? When Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, what happened? The Lord came down and said, where are you? Do you think God didn't know where he was, where Adam and Eve were? Do you think God didn't know why Elijah was there? Why ask the question? So Elijah could think of the answer. So does God ask us questions, especially when we're exhausted and tired, going 40 days and 40 nights, really without eating or drinking, and just collapsed in a cave? Yeah, it happens. It really does happen. We get depressed. Now, I could just talk about this all day long. And, you know, but Elijah gives the whole thing. He said, you know, I prayed for fire from heaven. It came down and consumed the altar. I killed all those bad priests. Why am I depressed? And what had happened? I mean, here he was, the Lord came to him, but what had happened? He had somehow lost that closeness with God. And even if he didn't lose that closeness, and you have to think, well, maybe he didn't too much because the Lord came to him, he felt like he lost that connection with God. And that's what depression does. It doesn't pull God away from you. It pulls you away from him so that you feel isolated and alone. And, you know, if you look at most suggestions on what to do when you're feeling depressed, Elijah kind of went through all of them the wrong way. When you're feeling depressed, it's important to be with somebody. It's important to eat properly. It's important to get your rest. It's important to keep your connection with God, even if it's nothing more than claiming promises. Even if it's nothing more, which I think is one of the greatest blessings, is our memory, which we're talking about tomorrow. Our memory gives us the ability to remember what God has done in our lives and through us in the past. I mean, we all have stories. And so it's time to share those stories when you're feeling most down. And when somebody is with you, if you're with somebody, if you're over here visiting a friend who's horribly depressed, there are a couple of questions I like to ask. The first question is, what do you like to do for fun? Okay? The two cardinal signs of depression, the first one is a depressed mood. The second one is lack of interest in having fun. That's sort of in my terms. But that's what it works. So that's a really good question to ask somebody. What do you like to do for fun? When's the last time you did it? And it's kind of interesting because I kind of stumbled on these questions. You know, the one about waking up and not feeling. These aren't standardized, tried questions. These are questions I use. But the question about having fun was one that came to me because several years ago I was at American Geriatric Society meetings. And there was a presentation there about the one question depression scale. And they studied it. And the one question depression scale is, are you depressed? And, you know, about 80% of the people that were depressed admitted that they were depressed. And so it was pretty good for a simple one question. So I thought, that's really neat. I'm going to use that because it's really fast. And in primary care, speed is the key. I mean, you can't spend a lot of time with these things because you don't have it. So it was really kind of funny because this lady came in. This is up at the manor, and she was really concerned for her visit. She said, you're going to see my husband next week, and I'm really worried about him. He's acting so depressed. And I asked her some questions, and I thought, well, this is a good question, good time to try my one question depression scale. So he comes in a week later, and he says, I said, are you depressed? And he looked at me, and he said, no, but, you know, my toenails are really bothering me. They're getting kind of thick and they don't fit in the shoe properly. And I thought, man, he got as far away from his head as he could get and stay in his body. You know, toenails. There he was. And so I just made this mental key that this is not a good question for elderly males, okay? And for most of the elderly, because they don't want to admit being depressed. And so so I developed this question, what are you doing for fun? And so I like asking that question. I had one young doctor say, well, that's a great pickup line. No, that's not why. But it's a good opener. What do you like to do for fun? It's a really neat question. So I had this, you know, a few weeks after that, this 87-year-old guy came in, and he was kind of mostly blind. He was one of the engineers that developed the dam that made Lake Powell. okay? Hoover Dam, okay? He's one of the engineers in charge of that. But anyway, really neat guy. But he comes in and he has this walker and he's kind of crippled and he shuffles in. And I said, "What are you doing for? What do you like to do for fun?" And he looked at me and he said, "I love whitewater rafting." And my heart stopped. You know, I thought, what's going to happen here? You know, this guy goes whitewater rafting. I said, "When's the last time you did it?" 1967. I said, "Good." Good. So you got to watch out for that answer. But it's an important question to ask. What are you doing for fun? It's a question you can ask yourself. What do you like to do for fun? When's the last time you did it? I think it's a simple question, and it's a good question to ask. The other question I would want to ask Elijah is, especially when he's depressed, is, and one of the problems in dealing with people that are depressed is, what happens to you? You start feeling kind of depressed. I mean, this black cloud is in the room, and it's really hard to deal with. I mean, it's not any fun, and it's quiet. I got a story about that too. But anyway, because this depression is really kind of a curious thing. But so the question I ask is, what is it like when you're not depressed? Now, I've done research in depression, and in research in depression, you have to ask these official questions. Is how long has it been since you've been depressed, this episode? How many episodes have you had in your life? And what happens is a depressed person looks at you like, these are the stupidest questions I've ever heard in my life. I mean, I'm depressed. Fix me, you know? But what is it like when you're not depressed? Because there are some people that when you ask that question when they're depressed, they light up and say, "Oh, it's wonderful when I'm not depressed. Oh, tell me about it," which is another really good line. Tell me about it. And they start painting pictures of sleeplessness and racing thoughts and things that kind of fit in the picture of mania. It's a different kind of depression, and you have to treat it differently, which is why you ask those questions. But getting back to Elijah, this really is about Elijah. At this point, Elijah's sitting there saying, "I'm it." You know, we had this wonderful demonstration on Mount Carmel that was supposed to bring everybody back to you. Okay? And I failed you. I'm all by myself. But if you read on, the Lord tells him, no, there's 7,000 other people who haven't bent their knees to Baal, which I think was a comfort for him. But the Lord also had something else to teach Elijah. Elijah had forgotten what it was like to feel close to God. Not because God was, because I'm convinced, I know in my experiences, that if you wander away from God, and we all do, you don't have to wander all the way back to be back with Him. As soon as you turn around, God is there, waiting for you. Every time. Okay? So Elijah had forgotten this. He was feeling depressed. He was feeling isolated. He was by himself. And so this is when God says, well, let's, you know, have the great storm, the great earthquake. But it was the still small voice. And we have to ask ourselves, are we still listening to that still small voice? Is that still small voice still part of our life? Now, most of us here, at least sometime in your life, I'm sure you've heard the still small voice. It's kind of a promise. It's called the Holy Spirit. It's our companion. May not be blatant, may not be words that are legible, that you can articulate, but you know what it's like. Share with your children what it's like so they can know why and know what to listen for. That's what God does here for Elijah. And so this is really important because I was reading things on the internet from different pastors and different churches that were talking about Elijah and how Elijah had just totally blown it. And he was just, you know, he was replaced. I mean, God said, okay, go anoint these guys and then I'm going to take you away. Well, Elijah wasn't quite finished. And I think that the best evidence that we have is that not the 7,000 people that haven't knelt to Baal, not the two kings that he anointed, not Elisha who was chosen to take his place, but I think one of the greatest evidences that Elijah wasn't too far from God is what happened when Jesus went up at the mount with Peter, James, and John. Who showed up? Moses and Elijah. What an honor. What God reaching out to Elijah saying, okay, buddy, here you are. We're together. I want you to go down and represent me and hear my voice. Proclaim the sovereignty of Jesus. Wow, it just gives me chills and goosebumps just thinking about that. And that's our scripture. Sorry, thumbs up or thumbs down? Okay. Our scripture that Jessica read for us. Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. This is a comfort to anyone who ever feels depressed. Now, I see a distinction between feeling depressed and being depressed, and that's we're going to talk about that tonight, the chemical imbalances and things like that, and what's done about that. But let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. I want you to come and stay in my house in heaven. I mean, that's just like God saying to Elijah, I want you to go down there when Jesus is anointed by me and I declare him as being the Savior. Wow. He's offering that to you. Isn't that neat? And when you're feeling depressed, or if you have a friend who's depressed, don't beat them over the head with this. Okay? They don't need to hear that. What they need to hear is you saying, I'm going to have a room in that mansion. And Jesus wants you there too. And I'm here for you. And be there for them. That's what someone who's depressed really needs. So I would kind of challenge you with that. Don't get to tell all my stories, but we will tell more stories later tonight. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about the memory part. But I want you to walk out of here feeling like Jesus is walking with you. Now, unfortunately, Bruce's voice is not doing really well. I love his voice. And so we're going to sing a hymn together. And if you could turn to hymn number 469, I think you might see the message in this one. Okay? Number 469. Sorry, that's yours. Oh, that's yours. Let's stand as we sing this.